Welcome to Lovers Forever. You might be wondering why there's another episode when in the last episode, Frank and Ava broke up, seemingly for good. But the story isn't that simple. I could have concluded with the last episode, but it's difficult to know where to actually stop. And in fact, this has been by far the hardest episode for me to write. I've been working on it for months while doing everything else in the podcast. The truth is, neither Frank nor Ava ever got over each other. Not really. Ava would never remarry. Frank remarried 2 times, though both marriages were essentially superficial. And Frank and Ava continued to be involved in each other's lives. Ava wrote in her memoir that she believed they'd be lovers forever. And in a way, they were. No matter who else was in the picture, they remained in love. In this episode, we'll look at the major moments of reconciliation, conflict, and support between the lovers up until Ava's death in 1990. But just know that there's even more that I didn't include. On June 12th, 1954, Ava arrived in Lake Tahoe. She was there to complete the 6-week Nevada residency required to file for divorce. She would have rather gone to Las Vegas, but incredibly, all 3 of her ex-husbands were once again performing in Las Vegas that summer, including Frank. So Tahoe it would have to be. She had called upon the largesse of Howard Hughes, who'd found her lakefront accommodations and paid an investigator to survey the premises. Hughes couldn't be with her at that time because, among other things, he was attempting to buy RKO Pictures out from under his stockholders, feuding with the Secretary of Defense over aircraft contracts, and helping another actress, Jean Peters, get a divorce herself. But he wanted to know about Ava's comings and goings. He sensed an opening. The investigator, who was overqualified, he was later involved in a CIA-backed assassination attempt of Fidel Castro. He had subcontracted the work to a local private detective. The private eye sat behind a bush in the woods, eating sandwiches and watching the house. One day, like clockwork, Frank Sinatra showed up. The detective watched through binoculars as Frank and Ava moved around the house. He deduced that Frank had come to try to reconcile with Ava. And Frank must have been at least somewhat persuasive because he got Ava to join him on a boat ride on the lake. Stupidly, the detective also rented a boat and went after them. It didn't take long before Sinatra noticed they were being followed and he went berserk and started chasing his would-be pursuer in the boat. The detective just managed to get to shore and scramble into the trees. Ava remained firm in her decision to divorce Frank. In the remaining 6 weeks, she had Luis Miguel Dominguez flown over, but they quarreled and he quickly left. He had too much pride to let a woman yell at him all the time, no matter how beautiful. Then Howard Hughes came to visit and proposed to her on yet another boat ride on the lake. "Come on, how about it? You've been married 3 times already. Don't you think it's my turn?" Ava laughed and turned him down. Newsmen waited in front of the courthouse on the day she was scheduled to testify. But she didn't turn up. She had decided to ask Frank to repay some of the money she'd loaned him through their time together. She didn't want alimony or a property settlement. Ava never asked for alimony from any of her 3 husbands. He had told her that he'd pay her back someday, and now he was riding high again. So this seemed to her a reasonable request. But Frank was angry at her for asking. That was what it was all about now, money. Ava was hurt. If money was all she cared about, she would have accepted that giant sapphire ring Howard Hughes had offered her on the lake. She wouldn't have come home to visit Frank from Europe when they were married, incurring an enormous tax burden as a result. Ava simply wanted him to repay his loans, many of which were to subsidize his extravagances, chartered planes and so on. It wasn't about the money in itself, it was about the principle. But Ava was so mad about the fact that he wouldn't pay his debts that she just abandoned the divorce proceedings altogether. Howard Hughes invited her to come with him on a business trip to Florida. She said yes. Throughout much of the next 2 years, they were in contact often. Ava was mostly living in Europe. No matter what you read about his dates with Gloria Vanderbilt, Frank Sinatra still long-distancing Ava Gardner all over Europe, Erskine Johnson reported in March of 1955. Night after night calls to the beauty who still misses Sinatra. In those days, long-distance calls really meant something, because it was extortionately expensive to call somebody on another continent. When Ava returned to Los Angeles in mid-1955 to shoot interiors for Bowani Junction, she and Frank were seen in public from time to time. With the benefit of some time apart, Ava's opinion of Frank had slowly changed. She had begun to think of him as the one person in her life she could always count on. She became nostalgic for him in Los Angeles, playing his records all the time at home. For his part, he clearly hadn't given up hope. He was known to tell phone operators to get Mrs. Sinatra on the phone. Frank was involved with Gloria Vanderbilt and probably several other people, at the very least. He had entered a period of prolonged bachelordom. In 1955, he recorded the album In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning. It has been hailed as one of the first true concept albums. It's structured somewhat like a two-act play. It was his first 12-inch LP with a total of 16 songs. That was a lot of songs for back then. I bring this album up because it remains his best album-length work, in my opinion. Or at the very least, definitely in the top five albums he ever did. And I want you to listen to it, preferably late at night if you can. And probably with some Jack Daniels. But the other reason I bring it up is because Frank and other people around him called it his Ava album. You see, Wee Small Hours is terribly sad. Almost all the songs ruminate on love gone wrong. Ava haunts the album like a beautiful ghost. Breakup albums are usually at least a little mean, but Sinatra doesn't take any pot shots at Ava. Instead, the primary mood is one of tenderness. While he was with Ava, he was having too many career troubles to be able to record great music. Remember, his record label had dropped him. But now, after they split up, she was serving as his muse, and his longing for her generated some of the best art he ever made. The following year, in 1956, Frank was in Spain for a 16-week location shoot. He was filming The Pride and the Passion with Cary Grant and Sophia Loren. Frank would be commuting to the set from the Castellana Hilton in Madrid. Ava lived roughly 20 minutes' drive outside the city. Frank told Hedda Hopper that if he met Ava while he was in Spain, it would be in some public place. It would be a casual matter. Hello, how are you? Goodbye. The soul of disingenuousness. Everyone knew that that was not how the couple interacted. And yet for a while, Frank resisted the temptation to go and see her. Ava ended up calling him herself. You goddamn jerk. You've been here how many days and you don't even call me? She yelled this salutation at him so loud that other people in the room with Frank could hear her on the line. I've been busy, Frank replied. Just then, Frank's current number one girlfriend, Peggy Connolly, walked into the room. Was that Ava? She asked. He said yes. Are you going to see her? Maybe. Peggy Connolly said she didn't like that. Frank, cool as ice, told her to go back into the bedroom, pack her things, and leave. And he did go see Ava. They went out to dinner somewhere and went to his room at the Castellana Hilton and went to bed. It was something of an extended liaison. At some point, though, he asked Connolly to come back. And when she did, she arrived at what had been their suite to see the bed unmade and a glimpse of Ava through the living room door. Peggy was 24, and youthful bravado spurred her into the room where she confronted Ava. Ava, Connolly said, looked at me from under her eyebrows, didn't say anything. I just got my mail and walked out. Then Peggy went to the location shoot where Frank was working. He kissed her and nonchalantly asked, "How are things at the hotel?" And then Frank and Ava drifted apart again for a while. In the spring of 1957, Ava was in Mexico, filming her third Hemingway adaptation, The Sun Also Rises. She was 34 and beginning to notice signs of aging. She was also exhibiting a newfound paranoia of photographers, ironic for a woman who made her living on the silver screen. 34 doesn't seem so old to us now, but in classic Hollywood, it meant her expiration date was coming up. Greta Garbo had retired from movies at age 36, and Ava's one-time friend Lana Turner, only 37, was playing the mothers of teenage children. There's also the fact that Ava smoked and drank a lot and had for decades, and these things will catch up with you. She developed a weird platonic relationship with the writer and actor Peter Vertel. She had a volatile relationship with the Italian comedian Walter Chiari. And then in May, she went to the Department of Foreign Relations in Mexico City and registered a complaint for divorce. She claimed abandonment of their home for more than 6 months. In June, the suit was filed, and Frank didn't contest it. On July 5th, 1957, the judge granted Ava Gardner the final divorce decree, nearly 4 years after she and Frank had separated. Meanwhile, Frank's close friend Humphrey Bogart had died of esophageal cancer in January. It had been a devastating loss for Frank. When his career had been on the outs, Bogart and his wife, Lauren Bacall, who everyone called Betty, they'd befriended him. While Bogie's health had deteriorated, Frank had developed feelings for Betty. They may have even started having an affair while Bogie was still alive. Contemporaneous accounts kind of dance around the possibility, which to me makes it seem like it was even more likely to have actually happened. By the summer of 1957, after her husband had died, she and Frank started openly dating, and it was one of the more serious relationships Frank had in this period of his life. Ava, as Nelson Riddle said, taught him the hard way. She taught him a lot of things the hard way. She taught him how to sing torch songs the hard way, which is what Riddle's quote is originally referring to. She also taught him the hard way that it's not always safe to get too close to a woman from an emotional standpoint. He and Betty had bonded because of their shared loss, and he wanted to take care of Betty, be there for her. Still mired in grief, and pretty young to be losing husband, she was only 32, she fell head over heels for Frank. Then, in October, Ava made a terribly stupid choice. She was in Spain, at the ranch of a wealthy bull breeder she knew through Ernest Hemingway. She'd been drinking Spanish cognac and absinthe, a combination known in Spanish as sun and shadow. She got on the back of a big black horse and headed into the bullring. The horse reared when the bull charged, and Ava was thrown off the horse, hitting the ground face first. There was a giant purple bruise on her right cheekbone. She arranged to see the plastic surgeon Archie McKindo in England. He advised her to wait. It was a muscular trauma, and any attempt to fix it too soon could leave her permanently disfigured. So she waited, reclusively. When Frank heard what happened, he called to console her immediately. In December, he went to visit her. His biographer says they met in New York, where Ava was consulting with another plastic surgeon. Ava's biographer says they met in Madrid. When Frank saw how big the lump was on Ava's face, he said, "Honey, you ain't gonna make any films looking like that." The lump eventually deflated to about the size of a walnut. This was a terrible, terrible time for Ava. She was convinced it meant the end of her stardom and the end of her career. Her beauty was all she'd really been valued for in the industry and in the culture. If she didn't have that, would anyone buy tickets to see her next film? And if they didn't, how would she pay for the lifestyle to which she'd become accustomed? It's the cruelest of ironies that the world's most beautiful woman suffered such an accident. The director, John Huston, later remarked that Ava has well and truly paid for her beauty. This was true. She became even more paranoid of photographers. And when she went to set on her next film several months later, she had good reason to be. Someone hid in a cardboard box for hours to snap a photo of her. Hollywood loves to build a woman up so it can tear her down. We see this cycle all the time, even today, with child stars like Lindsay Lohan, and when people like Meg Ryan or Courtney Cox get botched plastic surgery. Beyonce takes one unflattering photo performing at the Super Bowl, and that's the photo every outlet happens to run. Ava's paranoia, that her beauty was all the industry and indeed the world valued her for, it was not an unreasonable paranoia to have. In fact, it was kind of true. Except for the one person, it seemed, who recognized the soul behind the beautiful face. Now, more than ever, Frank became for Ava a knight in shining armor, the one person she felt she could count on. It was not to be that way for Betty Bacall. After Frank Sinatra proposed to her, he abruptly dumped her when news of their engagement was leaked to the press. He was incredibly cold to Betty. She ran into him at a party after they'd broken up, and he looked right through her, as if she weren't there, as if she were invisible. By the time Ava did appear in another movie, her face was mostly back to normal. She was still under contract to MGM, and so she reluctantly went to Rome to film The Naked Maha. She was able to delay the actual filming by several months, calling for rewrites in hopes that the lump on her face would continue to get smaller. The script was bad, but all the rewrites between several writers working in different languages made it even worse. Fortunately, the cinematographer for that film, Giuseppe Rotuno, was brilliantly talented, and he had her lit and framed to reduce the appearance of the lump. I'll link to some still photos and freeze frames from the movie in the show notes so that you can see. He really did a remarkable job of camouflaging the lump on Ava's face. And people who were around her on set were still bowled over by how beautiful she was, lump or no lump. Mickey Knox, an American actor, remembered, "It was difficult to be in her company. If you've ever been in the presence of certain extraordinary women, you'll know what I mean. Facing beauty of that kind, it's not a completely pleasant experience. She gave you this ache in your gut because she was so appealing, and because she was not yours, you know? You felt a kind of vertigo being near her." One can imagine Frank nodding along with this assessment. There were multiple rendezvous between the lovers in the late 50s and early 60s. In 1959, Frank flew all the way to Australia just because she asked him to come and sing for her. He called a promoter in Australia and booked two shows there. Ava came to the one in Melbourne. He sang All of Me to her in the front row, just like when she had come to his show in Houston. He only had eyes for her. It was one of Sinatra's great live performances. Red Norvo, whose quintet was backing him, said, "I don't think he ever sang any better in his life." There was the predictable brouhaha with photographers after the show, with Sinatra telling one of them he would ram the camera down his throat if the guy took another picture. Ava went with him in a limousine to his hotel, and a group of reporters' cars followed them. They had champagne and food sent up to Frank's room and went to bed, and then didn't see each other again for over a year. From 1954 until the advent of the Beatles, Frank Sinatra was more or less the most powerful star in the entertainment industry, period. After, in the wee small hours of the morning, he'd made the record Songs for Swinging Lovers, another masterpiece, but an up-tempo, swinging masterpiece, as the title suggests. He sort of switched back and forth like this for several years. He'd produce a happy record, like Come Fly With Me, and then Frank Sinatra sings for Only the Lonely. Most of his albums hit number one on the Billboard chart. Come Dance With Me stayed on the chart for 140 weeks, becoming his most successful LP. Frank started making lateral moves to solidify his power. He chafed at being under contract to Capitol Records and started his own record label. I don't know if it's pronounced Reprise or Reprise, in 1960. He also had a complicated friendship with JFK, and was bitterly burned when that friendship turned out to be pretty transactional from JFK's perspective. It served as his introduction, more or less, into the world of politics. And then there was the birth of the Rat Pack, as Hollywood myth. It was all the result of Frank Sinatra interrupting Sammy Davis Jr.'s show on stage at the Sands Casino in Vegas, because Sammy's show was running long. Frank got up and jokingly pulled him off stage. Then the next night, Frank was performing and Dee Martin showed up on stage to razz his friend. Joey Bishop and Peter Lawford joined in too. Headliners interrupting each other's shows to joke around was very unusual, and it was a sensation. By February of 1960, the Sands Casino had 18,000 reservation requests. It only had 200 rooms. They were filming Ocean's 11 at the same time, and the collaborative mischief at the Sands no doubt added to that movie's allure. The Rat Pack was born, though Frank hated that terminology and referred to this group rather ponderously as the Summit. Frank himself became an icon during this period. He became the chairman of the board, which is how most people know him today. Ring-a-ding-ding, Swinging Down the Lane, Fedora, Jack Daniels, the song My Way. This was also a period where he didn't have a truly serious relationship with a woman. He dated the 22-year-old South African dancer Juliet Prowse, as well as actress Angie Dickinson. He had a relationship with Judith Campbell Exner, who was also the mistress of JFK and notorious mobster Sam Giancana. Talk about a conflict of interest. But Frank worked very hard at avoiding falling in love. I argued in an earlier episode that Ava, through her femme fatale roles in movies like The Killers, and in her public affair with Frank himself, embodied a powerful but suppressed female fantasy. She lived as what we might call a liberated woman a long time before it was possible for most women in post-war America. The attraction of that fantasy wasn't just financial independence. It went beyond that. Ava was, of course, very beautiful. That's part of the fantasy. The other part is that Ava embodied the radical freedom to live life on one's own terms, instead of following societal norms and expectations. In the myth of the Rat Pack, Frank embodied a powerful male fantasy, one that still exists. The political journalist Ronald Brownstein writes, "The Rat Pack embodied Hollywood's most elemental myth, that as its final reward, fame offered a life without rules, without the constraints of fidelity, monogamy, sobriety, and the dreary obligation to show up at a job every morning." The myth of the Rat Pack persists and finds new life, even in contemporary media. For instance, the show Mad Men has its own iteration of a Rat Pack, a group of suave and successful men who, at least for a time, endeavor to live either without rules or just outside their boundaries. Don Draper is the leader, the oft-imitated mid-century ideal. Of course, the brilliance of Mad Men is that it pokes holes in that myth. Don Draper has everything, but he's miserable, racked with self-loathing, and most of all, he's alone. We might draw a similar conclusion about Frank Sinatra. Even at the height of his fame and influence, even though he was never really alone, he never stopped being lonely. In 1963, Ava had an affair with French restaurateur Claude Turrell. He was something of an international playboy. He had once been the son-in-law of Jack Warner. He was used to famous people and beautiful women, but he had never met anyone like Ava. "Such highs and lows, this was Ava," he recalled to Lee Server. "Nothing between. Like a queen one moment, a scared child the next. The things she did were not those of an ordinary person. For instance, she was still very close to Frank Sinatra. She still had the greatest praise for him. And she would do something I found to be extraordinary. She would put one of his records on and have a private talk with him as he was singing. She would sit and listen and say, 'Yes, yes, I know.' Or another song, and she would say, 'No, don't say that. You must forget.' She would have a talk with the record itself. It was something almost mystical. It was really something to see." We've talked about this habit before. I opened this podcast series with it. To me, it demonstrates better than anything else the mystical bond at the heart of Frank and Ava's love affair. Part of me likes to think that somewhere, probably under the California desert sky, Frank could hear her assurances. And then in June of 1963, Frank and Ava reunited again. They'd been speaking on the phone a lot in the preceding months. Ava had moved into Frank's penthouse, and Frank told friends, "She's back. And I'm the happiest man in the world. It's on, all the way." But, as ever, there was a bump in the road. It was Sam Giancana, the mobster. Frank and Sam, nicknamed Mooney because he was fucking crazy, were very close. Frank had a long-standing mutual fascination with mobsters. Ava thought they were lowlifes and creeps, and she hated them. They had argued about it when they were together before, and it was still a bone of contention now. Giancana hated Ava. As his own brother Chuck put it, he never liked women who were smart enough to ask intelligent questions. And Ava was much smarter than she gave herself credit for, and spoke her mind and could not be intimidated by the likes of these bums. That summer, Mooney and Frank were particularly close, and so when the gangster joined Frank and Ava's table at dinner one night, Ava got up. She excused herself, saying, "There's a fellow over there I simply must see." "Who the hell's that?" Frank said. Ava sat next to a man across the room who was dining by himself. She flirted with him, obviously for Frank's benefit, eventually climbing onto his lap and giggling. She looked back at Frank to make sure he was aware. Ava did always know how to get under his skin. He walked over there, pushed Ava off the fellow's lap, and pulled him up by his collar. "You're lucky I don't kill you with my bare hands, you idiot. Who the fuck do you think you are? Are you crazy? You want to die?" Then he dragged Ava by the arm back to their table. She took Mooney's drink and threw it in Frank's face and left. "Buddy boy," said Mooney, laughing. "I ain't never seen anything like that. That was classic." Now, if it were me, and the love of my life didn't like one of my friends because said friend was involved in racketeering, arms smuggling, money laundering, CIA assassination attempts, and had probably killed some people, I don't know, I'd probably distance myself from said friend. But that's just me. Frank insisted that Ava come with him to a party Mooney was throwing for his girlfriend, the singer Phyllis McGuire. Ava didn't want to go, but Frank demanded it, so she went, but they argued the whole time. And the next morning, she left. In fact, she walked out on him in front of several of his friends, with her suitcase in hand. She opened the door, gave a little wave, and was gone. Waiting for her on the other side of the door, apparently, was a Spanish airline pilot. Frank was stunned, and the rest of his crowd sat in silence, not knowing what to say. On December 8th, 1963, an incredibly strange event happened. Frank Sinatra's son, Frank Jr., was kidnapped at gunpoint. The 19-year-old had been performing at Harrah's Resort in Lake Tahoe when two random dudes came into his dressing room and dragged him out in a blindfold. The brains behind this operation, Barry Keenan, was so nervous that he left his gun in the hotel room. I mean, how much of an amateur can you be? When Frank heard the news, he chartered a plane to Reno, flying through the middle of a blizzard. There were no updates that night of his son's whereabouts. He chain-smoked and waited by the phone. Bobby Kennedy called. There had been bad blood between the two men, and as I've never delved into Frank's political involvements with the Kennedys, it's too complicated to explain why. But Bobby was the Attorney General, and he promised Frank that the Justice Department would prioritize the investigation. Mooney Giancana offered to do his own form of investigating, and Frank told him to lay off and let the FBI handle it. Pat Brown, the California governor, was in touch. And then J. Edgar Hoover called and told Frank not to talk to any press. At first, law enforcement was looking for bank robbers who'd been active in the area. The wrong guys. Frank communicated to the press through an intermediary that he was ready to make a deal with the kidnappers. No questions asked. Barry Keenan, whose idea it was to kidnap Frank Jr., was not a cold-blooded killer. He was a guy with too many problems. He was addicted to oxycodone and alcohol. He owed his family a lot of money. He was down on his luck. And he was hearing voices, including the voice of God. The voice of God apparently told him he would not hurt Frank Jr. and that he had to pay the money back. He had a detailed plan in a 3-ring binder. He'd invest the ransom money in Chrysler stock and in real estate projects, repay his debts, and then repay what he had borrowed from Sinatra all within the next 5 years. As it happened, ironically, Chrysler stock went sky high, and the real estate project he would have invested in became Marina Del Rey. So he probably would have been able to get away with his ambitious plan, aside from the minor problem of, going to prison. Keenan had pressed another guy into his scheme, a small-time criminal named Joe Amsler, and still another named Johnny Irwin. At first, Frank Jr. cooperated with his kidnappers because he believed he was a robbery victim that had just been taken hostage. But when he realized he had been kidnapped for ransom, he was furious. He said, "Fuck you," when Keenan asked for his father's private phone number. "Go ahead, shoot me," said Junior. "Go ahead, I fucking dare you, shoot me." It must have been hard for Frank Jr. to live in his father's shadow. But you can't deny, the kid had some guts. While Frank was waiting nervously by the phone in Reno, Ava heard the news in Mexico, where she just finished filming The Night of the Iguana. The story seemed to upset her a great deal. She sat up all night with an acquaintance, Nellie Barquette. She was crying. "That boy, he could have been my son," she said. She had never had a child, she told Nellie, and she regretted it. "She could have had one with Frank Sinatra," she said. She was inconsolable, unable to stop crying. She admitted to Nellie that she was still in love with Frank Sinatra, and it was so painful to be in love with someone who she could never have. The whole ordeal was eventually resolved after 2 days, with a lot of absurd mishaps from the bumbling kidnappers. Frank Jr. was released by one kidnapper on the North Sepulveda exit from the San Diego freeway at 2 a.m, and he started walking towards Bel Air. A private policeman found him and brought him home. Because the kidnappers had insisted on communicating only by payphone, Frank grew paranoid about running out of coins, started carrying 10 dimes with him. He would continue to carry 10 dimes on his person for the rest of his life. He was even buried with 10 dimes in his pocket. Frank Jr. was unharmed, but he was never able to live the event down. And bizarrely, a conspiracy theory blossomed that the whole ordeal had been some kind of hoax or publicity stunt. There's no reason to assume this is true, but the theory followed Jr. for the rest of his life. Sometime in the spring of 1964, Frank came to New York to visit Ava while she also happened to be in town. Ava's friend Nan Birmingham was with her and recalled that he brought her some flowers and one of his new record albums. Their relationship with each other was just charming, Nan remembered. They were so cute together, it was hard to imagine what I had heard about them. The fights, the crazy arguments, throwing ketchup at each other and all this stuff. They were something together. You could see he was still mad for her. Then, that summer, Ava was in Rome, shooting The Bible, a movie directed by John Huston and co-starring George C. Scott. Ava was playing Sarah. Scott would be playing Abraham. Scott tended to play the bad guys in movies, a menacing, intense presence. Turns out, that's because he was that kind of guy in real life, or at least he could be. He had a serious alcohol problem. It unleashed his violence, especially against women. He had tried to kill a longtime girlfriend twice. He was now married with a new baby and had been on the wagon for a while. But then he fell passionately in love with Ava, and he quickly fell off the wagon. The relationship started out sweet, with Scott totally besotted and obsessive. It must have reminded her a lot of her relationship with Frank, which was part of the appeal. But then, one night during an argument, she mentioned Frank Sinatra's name, and Scott knocked her over and punched her in the head repeatedly, continuing until she could taste blood in her mouth. Somehow Ava got out of there, and in the morning, he apologized profusely and promised he'd never do it again. Her face was black and blue. Peter O'Toole, also acting in the movie, wanted to beat up Scott on Ava's behalf. Director John Huston apparently intervened, according to his son, who was visiting the set at this time. Ava thought of quitting the picture, but Houston persuaded her to continue, and she kept him at a distance. She never told Frank about what happened, but he found out. When the Bible's shoot moved south to Sicily, Ava noticed three huge men showing up to set every day. You know the type. Mafia heavies. They were in Sicily, after all. In her memoir, she assumes that John Houston had hired them for her protection, but it was probably really Frank. Gradually, she reconciled with Scott because he had performed the whole loving contrition thing that abusers do. One night, Ava and Scott were at dinner, arguing again. He raised his hand to strike her, and the three men appeared out of nowhere and dragged him into a car. Some say they delivered an ultimatum. Lay off Ava, or else. Around this time, Ava flew up to Rome one long weekend to visit Frank, who was shooting the movie Von Ryan's Express. Maybe she knew that he was the one who'd set up that goon squad to protect her and she was feeling grateful. Maybe she just missed him. They were affectionate with each other, but unlike so many of their other periodic reunions, there was no sexual contact between them. The reason is a terribly sad one. Frank's friend, Brad Dexter, recalled that at dinner with the couple, Ava drank herself into a stupor and stumbled upstairs to bed. Frank said to Dexter, "She's the only woman I've ever been in love with in my whole life, and look at her. She's turned into a falling down drunk." Of course, given the strain of her relationship with Scott and the grueling shooting schedule, I can understand why Ava wanted to numb herself with alcohol. The relationship with Scott continued. John Houston had to physically restrain Scott one night in the hotel bar. He was taken to a hospital and pumped full of tranquilizers. But his presence was required on set. He was playing Abraham. His role ran through almost half the movie. If he didn't return and he had to be replaced, they'd have to do significant and expensive reshoots. And while Houston did everything in his power to protect Ava physically, he also asked her to persuade her abusive boyfriend to return to set. Imagine what that must have been like for Ava. Imagine having to plead with a man who occasionally sometimes wanted to murder you to come back and work with you for 16 hours a day so that the investors would stay happy, so that the movie didn't go over budget. Hollywood has always been a brutal, brutal place. The relationship with Scott continued into 1965. She finally seemed to evade him for good one night in London. And then later that year, when she was staying in a Beverly Hills hotel bungalow, he broke in and said, "I won't give you up. I'd rather see us both dead." Somehow, Ava pleaded for mercy, and he listened to her. Ava called her doctor, who raced over and administered a powerful sedative. George C. Scott fell asleep for a while, and then his eyes popped awake. He got up and disappeared out the back door. That, finally, was the end. But whenever one of his movies came on television, she would experience something like a panic attack, remembering. In 1966, Ava got a phone call from Frank's valet, George Jacobs. On his boss's orders, he was calling to tell her that Frank was going to marry Mia Farrow. In a different account, from a friend of Ava's, Frank called Ava himself, saying, "I hope I'm not making a big mistake." Ava told him to reconsider the marriage, according to this account. It's too late. The judge is standing right there. Mia Farrow was 21, and Frank was 50. He was inching toward death, and the actress had promised him new life. We know the story. Mia was a willowy flower child through and through, with huge blue eyes and a pixie cut, who hung out with the Beatles and smoked marijuana. Frank was the kind of person who would try to get you thrown out of a nightclub if you were wearing shoes he deemed too casual. They were from two different planets. When she first heard news of the relationship, Ava had cracked to a reporter, "I always knew Frank would end up in bed with a boy." But when she heard they were getting married, she felt an overpowering sense of loss and cried the whole rest of the night. It turned out that this May-September pairing was short-lived. Frank and Mia were separated by late 1967, and he divorced her in 1968. By that point, Ava had left Spain for London, where she would live for the rest of her life. In June of that year, she made a journey to St. Joseph's Hospital in Frank's private plane. She had elected to undergo a total hysterectomy. Her mother had died of uterine cancer, and so when Ava discovered a fibroid tumor in her uterus, she just decided to cut the whole thing out. Walter Winchell reported that she convalesced at Frank's Palm Springs house. Frank supposedly paid her hospital bill, too. The hysterectomy seemed to trigger a dark depression in Ava. She eventually went on the medication Elavil. But through the darkness, Frank was there, generous and dependable. Ava had worked very periodically in films and eventually television after moving to London. She also changed as a person. Her paranoia and mood swings more or less faded away. There were no more wild nights on the run from the paparazzi. Sometimes she would even quit drinking for several months at a time. She lived a more sedate, quiet life with her beloved corgis and a young maid named Carmen. People who knew her in her middle age described her as outrageously generous. She would bring homeless people up to her fancy apartment, which was filled with priceless antiques, and feed them, or send them in a taxi to her doctor. She brought flowers and food to sick neighbors. Finally, by her late 40s, Ava had started to settle down. But when she wanted to get out of London, she was always free to use any of Frank's properties as vacation homes. In 1976, Frank remarried for the fourth and final time to Barbara Marks. Barbara resented the close relationship Frank shared with his second wife, so Frank became more distant. He still checked in on Ava and sent her letters, but less often. For more than 20 years, Frank had kept a marble statue of Ava from her movie The Barefoot Contessa in his backyard. He had purchased it from the film company, presumably after they separated, and transported it all the way from Italy to Los Angeles. One day, shortly after marrying Barbara Marks, a truck came and hauled the statue away. Its whereabouts remain unknown. By 1986, Ava had developed a hacking cough. Gradually, she also developed chest pains and had trouble breathing. Panicked, she flew to Los Angeles and checked into St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. They tested her for lung cancer but found none, even though she'd been a heavy smoker her entire adult life. She apparently had pneumonia. They administered treatments in the hospital and she got better, but then, 11 days into her hospital stay, Ava suffered a stroke. The left side of her body was numb, partially paralyzed, including her face. She could speak, but it was hard to understand her because of her contorted face. Fortunately, there wasn't any damage to her judgment or memory or cognitive ability. Ava stayed in the hospital on oxygen and medication, closely monitored in case another stroke was imminent. Frank would call, but Ava couldn't speak to him. The nurses held up the phone to her ear, and he told her, "I love you, baby. It stinks getting old." Then suddenly, Frank too was taken ill. In Palm Springs, he underwent a 2-hour operation that removed a large portion of his intestine. He recovered relatively quickly, but he had to wear a colostomy bag for months, which humiliated him. Again in 1987, Ava flew to Los Angeles for medical treatment. She had chartered a private plane back to St. John's because of a flare-up of her pneumonia symptoms. It's possible she may have also suffered from lupus, although I haven't been able to confirm that. She was in the hospital for 2 weeks. Frank didn't call this time. That wife of his. But his attorney called Ava's financial advisor and offered to help with the great expense of the chartered plane and the hospital bills. Frank ended up paying her $50,000. There's no denying it was a generous gift. Ava was still upset that he had not contacted her personally. For decades, every year on her birthday, Frank sent Ava an enormous bouquet of yellow roses. She would keep the flowers in the vase, dead and petrified, all year, until a fresh bouquet was delivered. He sent her one as usual in 1989 when she was 67. A month later, on January 25th, 1990, Ava died of bronchial pneumonia. When he heard the news, his eyes had filled with tears. He slumped over in his chair. He cried out, "Why wasn't I there for her? Why wasn't I there to help her?" His daughter Tina remembered that he had gone into his room and stayed there alone all night and all day. The next time he spoke to her, his voice was barely audible, just a whisper. He did not attend her funeral. Again, his jealous wife kept him away. But he did send a flower arrangement to her funeral in Smithfield, North Carolina. Among the many bouquets, his was the largest and most beautiful. The florist who received the order got butterflies when she saw Frank's signature on the check and almost wanted to keep it as a souvenir. But it had been a very large order and a very large check. By now, you might wonder, why do I personally care so much about this story? Why am I so invested in the story of Frank and Ava that I would do an entire season of a podcast about them? There are the superficial aspects. It's just a wildly entertaining story to me, and in many ways it touches on my own personal obsessions. Hollywood history, how glamour operates as a phenomenon, the weird dissonance in American mid-century culture. As I hope I've elucidated in this series, Frank and Ava became such a cultural phenomenon because they went against the expectations of their time so flagrantly. The post-war period was supposed to be about respectability, conformity, and small-town family values. Frank and Ava had nothing but contempt for those expectations, and that made them very fascinating to people. And they couldn't have gotten away with it without being Frank Sinatra and Ava Gardner. If Frank wasn't a great singer with a volatile inner life, a lonely only child, descendant of Italian immigrants, if Ava wasn't a tobacco farmer's daughter arriving in Hollywood like Venus rising from the sea, whose surreal beauty made people treat her as both more than human and less than human, they would not have held the public's attention beyond the initial scandal. It's the drama of two archetypes, the ultimate artist and the ultimate muse. But there are other reasons, deeper emotional ones, that have kept my eyes trained on Frank and Ava. There's a great deal of moral ambiguity around how they treated each other, a thorny knot which I can never untangle because Really, only Frank and Ava know the whole story of what happened between them. In an earlier episode, I mentioned that we always want the one who hurt us to be the one that heals us, and that in most cases, that is utterly impossible. However, in the end, in their own way, Frank and Ava defied the odds on this front. They became, in time, each other's steadfast companions. It turned out that they could always be there for each other, as long as they never got too close. Frank especially came to Ava's aid time and time again, as we've seen. Whether it was sicking mafia heavies on George C. Scott, or paying for her medical treatment. When they were married, Ava was the one with the resources and the power, and she supported him in his lowest time. After they split up, the power dynamic shifted, and Frank was the one with the resources and the power. And so their post-divorce relationship can be understood as Frank repaying his debt to Ava, not only by helping her financially from time to time, but also by becoming the person she could always count on. Their love could only survive as a positive force from a distance. Get too close, and it was like stars colliding. Beautiful flashes of light, but ultimately destruction and chaos follow. What they needed instead, and what they did, was to adopt the careful dance of a planet and her satellite. Love me, from 60,000 miles away. By now you may have also guessed that I have been in a relationship like this one, where the uncanny, mystical insight between two people could have been nourishing and generative, but instead turned destructive. And I had such a hard time explaining to people in my life why I had loved that other person so much, even when our staying together wasn't healthy. And so I relate profoundly to both Frank and Ava. I relate to Ava as a woman whose true nature is often in conflict with what is expected of her as a woman, especially in relationships. I relate to her insecurities about her intelligence and how her perceived value will shift as she ages, and how when men say they love you, what they often really mean is that they want to possess you. I know how much that hurts. On the other hand, I relate to Frank as someone who is always looking for release from intense psychic pressure, who is too sensitive for his own good. I relate to his longing to create great art. And I relate to him because the one I loved was also outrageously beautiful. And it's very hard to love someone that beautiful when you are yourself pretty plain. What Frank and Ava wanted from each other, I believe, was transformation. And this, most of all, is what I relate to. In that other person, I believed I could be redeemed, made new again, made clean and fresh like a meadow in spring. I looked into his eyes, and I saw the world begin. At some point, I think he felt the same way about me. Frank and Ava stuck with each other because they believed they would become better. They loved each other so much that they believed the love alone would make them worthy of each other. He looked into her eyes, and he saw the world begin. But I don't think love works if you treat it like a grail quest. And I don't think you can expect the other person to transform you. In order for their marriage to really work, they would have both had to be in therapy, I think. They would have had to dig into the reasons why they felt compelled to cheat on each other. And they would have had to communicate without trying to mortally wound the other person's ego. They would have had to learn to communicate non-violently and make amends. Probably they would have had to cut back on their drinking, or even cut it out altogether. The other person alone can't make you do that. You have to learn to do those things, and it's hard work, all of it. I guess the saddest thing of all is that I do believe in their love. I believe if they had done that work, they would have been together all their lives. They would have realized that paradise was just holding the other person's hand. I believe Frank and Ava could have grown old together, two legends staring into the same fireplace at night. And I hope that somewhere, right now, they are together, looking into the fireplace. And she is saying to him, "I love you, Francis." And then he smiles his blue eyes at her and says, "I love you too." Thanks for listening to Lovers Forever. This episode was written, narrated, and edited by me, Amber Nelson. All the music is from Epidemic Sound. The logo was designed by Abby Scheel. We're distributed by Buzzsprout. If you like Lovers Forever, please follow, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts, and tell your friends about it. You can find us online at Lovers Forever Podcast on Instagram.